Hey, this is the Popmatic Podcast for August 20th, 2014. Summer Challenge, Summer Schmallenge. We blew that bugger out of the water. All those old encyclopedias, I bench press with those. This is the Popmatic Podcast, where you can rock out with your library card out. And joining me today are...
Mike.
Crystal.
Bill.
Amanda.
And I'm Brian. Greg isn't here because Magic, the therapy horse, ate his homework.
You gotta watch it. It does that.
So this year's Summer Challenge, formerly known as Summer Reading, was a huge success. This year we set a citywide goal to see how many people we could get reading, doing things at the library, just learning new things, and the goal was 500,000, you know, and we reached 700,000, and that's a low estimate. We blew it out of the water. We're awesome. Cheers to Lindsay Patrick for rebooting this program, giving it all this new energy, getting so much involvement from the community. She even got us some national press. It was amazing. But this isn't just about us saying how awesome we are. This is about you, the listener, you, the library patrons. If you're not a library patron and you listen to this podcast, leave a comment. That's kind of weird. I'm flattered. But it's about you, the library patrons, and because you have met the goal of Summer Challenge, you get fine forgiveness for 1 week. Did you hear me? Did you hear that? You get your fines forgiven. Your fines go away. So between August 16th and August 23rd,
this is right now.
That's magical. Yeah. Just go to your library branch and say that you participated in Summer Challenge and you want your fines waived, and that'll be taken care of. Now, if you're observant and with it and not taking a ride on Magic the therapy horse.
My poor therapy horse.
It'll need its own therapy.
Like, there's only a certain demographic that could ride Magic the therapy horse.
Depressive people?
Elves?
Depressed elves? The forest looks so gray today.
And Amanda was observant. You'll notice that the 20th now, the day that you're probably listening to this, is right in the middle of that fine forgiveness period. So you have 3 days.
Ready, go.
You got this.
Exactly. To go and get your fines erased.
But what if I don't have any fines?
Then you could go
to the library. I need to go get some fines I can have them erased.
Thank your local librarian for being awesome.
If you participated in Summer Challenge,
I did.
You would still get personal prizes.
Yes.
That you, if you didn't get them, you could go get them. So you could get at least a tote bag, at least coupons to local attractions, and then also entered into a contest to win a trip to Dolly World. And also, because we've got the citywide goal, there will be community parties at your local branch. Now, when those are and what those consist of and who those are for, I bet some are probably just for elves and munchkins.
Magic horses.
And some are probably for adults. So it just depends on your branch. So pay attention at your local library and you can have fun at the party. Now, okay, I always bury the lead. We're talking about this because we're going to talk about the best stuff we read during summer reading, because we kind of had a summer reading kickoff episode. Now we're going to go back. We bench pressed a ton of encyclopedias. We learned a bunch of stuff. We had a lot of fun. We're going to go back and say what was the best stuff during that time, because technically I think summer reading started in May 1st.
Yeah, way
long. You know what I mean?
And then, a while ago.
And then we just we just did the rollout in pieces. So yeah, there's a lot of stuff for us to watch, read, break. Between then and now, we're going to tell you all about it. And stay tuned. Like, for Tickle My Fancy, we'll talk about Robin Williams. We know that that's on everyone's mind. Mike, can you cold start?
Ooh, I've never done the cold open before. Longtime listeners will remember that way back in the, I believe it was the Hispanic Heritage Month episode, that Hunter S. Thompson was one of my big obsessions when back in my college days. I've read most of his books except for his collections of letters because they're huge. But recently we got them both in audiobook. So I listened to the first one, The Proud Highway, The Saga of a Desperate Southern Gentleman, 1955 to 1967. It's basically a collection of letters during the period from Hunter S. Thompson's time in the Air Force, where he was working at the base newspaper, and he discovered that he wanted to be a writer. to just after the publication of Hell's Angels, the book that made his reputation. What really surprised me about it was just how much of just a regular guy he was, like how much of that persona was fabricated, you know, that kind of crazy screaming all the time, hyperbole, drug addict was just kind of a character, which was, it's kind of really neat, you know. I think it actually makes a better autobiography than his actual autobiography, which, as I recall, was incomprehensible garbage, and I will not recommend it here. I listened to it about over the course of about a month. It's 22 CDs, which seems to be a lot.
Those are long letters.
Yeah, it's every 3 minutes a piece, but that's a pretty easy bookmarking, but some of them would take up like 4 or 5 of those. If you are like me, don't really like audiobooks per se, I would still recommend this one because it feels a lot like a podcast. It's like a one-sided conversation. So like, you know, if you miss words or you're supposed to be working.
I typically ignore what everyone else in the booth is saying.
Yeah. You'll still know what's going on. And, narrator, I thought this was kind of amusing because he would always pause what are you saying whenever a book would start with the. So during the course of the book, Tom's is trying to write a book called The Rum Diary. So it's like, you know, I'm working really hard writing The Rum Diary. You know, The Rum Diary is taking me so long to write. It's like, man, guy, can you just say The Rum Diary? No, it's The Rum Diary. I wish he did do like a Hunter S. Thompson like impersonation, that kind of crazy Nixon-esque. And I was going to recommend a second book really quickly called The Footloose American Following the Hunter S. Thompson Trail Across South America by Brian Kevin, which is inspired by Thompson's letters from South America that he mentioned in The Proud Highway. He follows the exact trail that Thompson took across South America. It's pretty neat. It compares modern South America to 1963 South America, which, you know, in a nutshell, is less military dictatorships, but still mostly lots of poverty. It's also an amusing critique of backpacking culture in general. You know, like instead of saying, let's go someplace, it's let's do Quito. Or, you know, like if it's like some city, it's like, oh, it's just a city. No, let's go to Machu Picchu instead. It's a lot of fun. You know, it's not in a gonzo style, which is kind of a bummer, but it's a good travelogue, you know, of South America then and now.
Hunter S. Thompson was a compulsive letter writer.
Like, yes.
His whole career. A lot of people think that, you know, his letters is actually some of his best writing because it's basically just essays he wrote. So, you know, and a lot of times, especially after he got famous, they were sort of in persona and they would be to other famous people. So they're like nonfiction essays about historical events. Doesn't sound like those are the letters that you're talking about, but once you get to volume 2, right?
Yeah, I'm curious to see how he evolves because so far he's just a regular dude. But I think as he creates the persona, he'll probably get more like screaming and incoherent, which is a little bit more fun, but less interesting.
It's really interesting. You pointed out, too, that actually a lot of his public speaking persona, he actually stole that from Nixon.
Oh.
It's like weird.
Makes sense.
Nixon obsession that he had his whole life.
He hated him so much he became him. Yeah. So what do you got today, Bill?
My summer challenge favorite is Mr. Mercedes by Stephen King. It's a crime fiction novel. Not a supernatural or horror novel, so there's no bugs coming out of walls or voodoo or any of that stuff.
Darn.
In short, without giving much away, a psychopath takes a stolen Mercedes-Benz and drives it into a crowd of people at a job fair. A retired cop comes out of retirement with two unlikely allies to hunt the killer down. Mr. Mercedes is what Stephen King does best. He just tells a good story. He builds the story, introduces characters, and builds the suspense to an unbearable page-turning moment. For all Stephen King's fans, this November, a new King book will be released called Revival, and you can put it on hold right now. So, Crystal, what was your summer challenge?
All right. The best book I read during summer challenge was The Fever, the latest novel by the Edgar Award-winning Megan Abbott. The story takes place in a mid-sized Midwestern town. I've already forgotten the name of it because it could really be anywhere. We're at a high school where girls begin suffering strange seizures. First, it's Lise, then Gabby, and then Kim. But why? Is it because they were exposed to the polluted lake in the town? Was it the controversial HPV vaccine that the girls were given? Or something completely different? I don't want to give anything away, but let me just say that this book is a little like the movie Heathers, but instead of being darkly comic, the fever is deeply insightful into the hearts and minds of teen girls. And what you find there isn't all sugar and spice, let me tell you. Here's my favorite quote from The Fever. Sexual debut. Sometimes it seemed to Deanie that high school was like a long game of, and then there were none. Every Monday, another girl's debut. All right, so if you aren't familiar with Megan Abbott, listen up, my friends. I think of Abbott as the brilliantly talented underdog writer, although admired by fellow novelists such as Sarah Gran and Gillian Flynn, she has yet to find a wide audience for her books. She's got some cred, though. She earned a Ph.D. in literature from New York University, and she's the current John Grisham writer-in-residence at the University of Mississippi. Abbott is a big fan of film noir movies and hard-boiled detective stories, and she's written authoritatively on both. Abbott and her fellow writer friend Sarah Gran, both Gen Xers, they grew up reading V.C. Andrews. They co-wrote a thoughtful piece upon the 30th anniversary of Flowers in the Attic, and we'll link to that into the show notes. This summer, Abbott wrote the New York Times review of Bill's favorite Summer Challenge book, Mr. Mercedes, and very appropriate considering it was King's first hardboiled detective novel, and she's an expert. So, read The Fever, if not because I said so, because Gillian Flynn tells you how strangely beautiful and utterly unshakable it is right on the front cover of the book.
That might be, you know, try to sneak that into my book club if you don't try to sneak it into yours.
All right.
Are you going to try to sneak it into your book club?
I don't know.
YA book?
Rock, paper,
nope.
Scissors?
It's not a YA book. No. There's lots of drinking and drugging and sex in here. So
I thought that's what all the YA books were about.
Yeah. Okay. And they're all teenagers. Yeah, that sounds
right.
Familiar.
But yeah, it's a great, great thriller. Really makes you think. And Bill, you put a hold on it, right? Lined up to read it as soon as your copy comes in.
I'll just wait and see what Bill says about it.
There you go. Or wait for the movie. I don't know if it's optioned, but it should be.
It probably will be shortly.
So, Amanda, what was your favorite summer challenge?
Well, the official theme for summer challenge this year was science. So I thought, how nice that my book is scientifical in nature. I read, it's called Sudden Sea. It's by R.A. Scotti. I had never heard of her before, but it deals with the Great Hurricane of 1938. And for us, I think that our benchmark of New England storms would have to be Hurricane Sandy. I knew that hurricanes would go all the way up the East Coast, but Sandy was the first one I ever actually saw do it. But there have been a handful of pretty nasty storms that have made it up into New York and Connecticut. And in 1938, it actually hit in September, so it was about this time of year, a little later. It formed off of the Cape Verde Islands in Africa, and the newbie weathercaster in Florida kind of caught it. In 38, they pretty much took all their sea measurements from ships. Like, ships would measure pressure, and, you know, they would get reports back from ships, and so they knew that there was this disturbance out there, and so he was kind of watching it, and he actually, and I don't remember his name, but kind of like Crystal, it's not really important to the story, but I do remember that he was kind of the new guy on the staff, and he actually issued a hurricane watch or warning for Southern Florida, and so they battened down the hatches and everybody, and then it turned, but everybody was so happy because, you know, he had them all prepared and they were ready for it, because that was kind of unusual at that time. And then when it turned and went north, they passed it off to the up next weather bureau, which was, I believe, in Washington, D.C., and then the, you know, old hats, they were like, oh, it's going to go out to sea, we won't have to worry about it, blah blah blah, and this kid in Florida was like, no, there's kind of a high sitting out there over, but it's not going to turn. So we should, like, oh, it's going to, they always turn, you know. So they kind of wrote it off. And in the meantime, this storm just keeps growing and growing and growing. And off the coast of Cape Hatteras, it reached a Cat 5 status. So it was this huge storm sitting out there that basically people were ignoring. And they were just kind of, hey, it's going to rain, yay. And it was actually also the fastest moving storm. It had forward motion of 70 miles per hour, which just increases, I don't do math on all that about how, like, if your storm is moving faster, that increases the winds in it just because of the forward motion of the storm. So that really didn't give it a lot of time to weaken before it slammed into Long Island. It didn't weaken to a Cat 3, which is what Hurricane Katrina was when she hit. So you can tell how bad of a storm this was on September 21st. And we're lucky that it didn't hit before. This was post-Labor Day. Most of the folks that had houses on Long Island had closed up their beach house and gone back to work and gone back to the city. And so there was just kind of actually a lot of women and children that were just kind of hanging out, you know, closing up their house, getting ready to shut it down for the summer. And here comes this big storm. And all the folks that in the book that told the story said it just kind of got cloudy. And then, like, this big wall of water just came across, and they showed pictures of the, like, Long Island Sound, and where they had these beautiful beach houses. And then after the storm, there was nothing. Like, there wasn't debris, there wasn't anything. It was just, it looked like this beautiful spit of sand. So the storm really shocked a lot of people with direction and intensity, and it ended up killing, they estimate between 700 and 800 people. Mostly from the storm surge that just kind of wiped everything off. It made two landfalls. It hit Long Island. It also hit, then it went across the, is that Long Island Sound behind, I guess, or whatever that strip of water is, hit Connecticut, and it caused about $306 million in property damage, which in 2014 dollars was $4.7 billion worth of property damage, which still makes it second to Superstorm Sandy, but it was still a massive hurricane. The interesting, Catherine Hepburn was actually at her family house in Old Saybrook, Connecticut, and she had gone out and played golf that morning and taken a swim and got caught in the storm and had to leave her house, crawl through the ditch, and, like, get to higher ground during the storm that swept across, and her family's house basically was blown away. And there's an anecdote that she called her dad and said, "Hey, you know, I'm safe." And he's like, "Where's your mom?" And she's like, "It's a safe." And she's like, "But Dad, the house is gone." And he's like, "Well, did you throw a match in it?" He's like, "Because it's insured for fire damage, but it's not insured for flood damage." So, thanks, Dad, for caring about the safety. But so, and this was before, this was 38, so this was before Catherine Hepburn was the huge Catherine Hepburn that we know. She was just kind of getting started on her career. But she did make it through the 1938 hurricane. And this book was really good. Like, I read it, the whole thing, in less than 24 hours. Like, I didn't want to put it down. So, highly entertaining.
Insurance hacks.
Throw a match in it.
Speaking of science, okay, Greg isn't here, but I know that he was going to talk about how much fun it was and surreal to have the miniature horse here at the library. We joked about that a little bit. But I also wanted to give a shout out to another program that happened during summer reading, and that was the fermentation workshop with Sandor Katz. And I didn't get to go that day because I just was busy that Saturday, but the library has the DVD, and I don't know if it's exactly what you would have heard if you would have came and seen Sandor Katz in person, but you definitely can watch the DVD and hear his spiel about food cultures in culture and what that means and why it's important and his approach to fermenting food. I found the DVD really enjoyable. It was good. And I didn't want to pitch it beforehand, even though I knew the library had it, because I wanted people to come to the program. But, you know, hopefully, you know, too, he will come back because he does, he lives in Tennessee. All right, so this isn't tickling our fancy, but this happened, and I think maybe we should probably talk about it, is the death of Robin Williams, he was a genius, right? Not only was he an extremely funny comedian, he also was an amazing dramatic actor and did kids' movies and adult movies, and there is some movie of his that you watched that probably affect you very deeply. I know for me it was funny. I actually saw Dead Poets Society when I was a kid. I think that came out in 89, and I saw it when I was, like, you know, 10 or 11. It, like, really affected me very deeply. And, of course, factoids, I think most people know from Nashville know that the school in Dead Poets Society is based on Montgomery Bell Academy, and the Robin Williams character, John Keating, is based on a teacher there, Sam Pickering. I think a lot of folks know that. So there's that connection. I just wanted to give a chance for any of the podcast crew to share their thoughts or memories about Robin Williams.
I mean, I love him in Aladdin. That's my favorite Disney movie. But I would go clear back to when he was on Mork and Mindy. That was the first time I really remember Robin Williams being Robin Williams. And I don't even know when that show was. I was little. I was like 5 or 6. And we would always turn on Nanu, Nanu, and watch. The egg kind of creeped me out, though. I'm not going to lie. That whole part, I'm like, that was kind of weird. But
I was thinking Jonathan Winters came out of the egg. That was a little weird. But
I did like the rainbow suspenders. And I think... I can't remember if I had a pair or somebody had a. I feel like there was a pair in my life at some point of rainbow suspenders because.
As more celebrities, comics are paying tribute to him, I'm just amazed at how much he had his finger on the pulse of, you know, these underground comics and music. Questlove of the Roots shared a really touching story of meeting Robin Williams on an elevator back in 2001, and he was like naming off albums, and he was just stunned that this middle-aged white guy like knew his music, and he was so touched by that. And of course, you all have heard me talk about the Mighty Boosh. They came here to the States. It was back in 2010 and did a show out in Los Angeles, and Robin Williams was there quoting the Crack Fox. I mean, so they were just completely stunned. But you know, for him to take the time to acknowledge these young comics and their genius is just pretty amazing to consider that, along with his whole body of work.
And, you know, one of the things that's kind of been making the rounds is Mark Maron's interview with him, because we've talked about Mark Maron's podcast on this podcast in the past, where Mark Maron does these long-form interviews with celebrities, and really, usually he gets them to go really deep and reveal things they don't normally reveal. And the one with Robin Williams, I mean, it wasn't a great interview from, I think, in the sense of the way that Mark Maron will really psychoanalyze people, but it is extremely scary. At the very end, Williams goes into this one of these famous monologues he does with himself, where he has a conversation inside his own head about whether or not he should commit suicide. And, you know, Robin Williams is a really great actor. He can, just in a few seconds, you know, he can take you someplace. And that's like the last 5 minutes of the interview.
Wow.
It was scary. And that was in 2002.
2010.
Yeah, I was going to say 2002 is a little early for podcasting.
I'm glad you guys corrected me this week. Because
I was going to wait for you to fail next week so I could laugh. But,
well, I would just have to put it in the, I just have to put it in the corrections next week. But we can correct on the fly. All right. So, yeah.
Nanu, nanu, oh, captain, my captain.
Now to funner things. Mike.
Oh, well,
what's tickling your fancy this
week? There
you
go.
So I read a book recently during the summer challenge that I thought like I'd also mention here on the Tickle My Fancy as a close runner-up, called Promise of Blood by Brian McClellan. It's under a genre that's either like flintlock fantasy or flint punk or something. It's fantasy. It takes its inspiration from the 18th century early modern era, as opposed to the Middle Ages or the Victorian era. So there's a lot of like muskets and gunpowder and guillotines and, you know, basically.
So let's do a flint punk episode.
Oh boy. I've got one book. Ha! Yeah, you guys are in trouble. Basically, the plot is that the field marshal of this fictional fantasy land leads a bloody coup against the king and has the nobility guillotine. part of the book is where he tries to consolidate power and eventually usher in a democratic society, you know, tyranny now, but democracy later. And the rest of the book is an investigation of a cryptic warning that all of the king's mages gave before they were executed. And there's a class warfare element, which is kind of like the symbolism that's in everything nowadays. The nobility with magic powers are called privileged. They can essentially do whatever they want. They can like manipulate fire and, you know, water and air and all that kind of stuff. But the lower classes who get magic powers are called powder mages, and they get the ability to manipulate gunpowder and bullets. It's really cool. There's one bit where like they can ignite the gunpowder and like people like from like 20 feet away, they can ignite the gunpowder in their gun so it explodes in their face, or they can throw bullets in the air and like, you know, throw them at people and like a gun. Was that the privilege are almost always like jerks and the power mages are like the heroes of the book, you know, kind of. I really thought it was really cool. It's kind of dark. It's not as dark as you know, I just said, because, yeah, well. I thought the powder mage thing is really neat. There are bits of it that reminded me of Bernard Cornwell's Sharp series, that kind of like Napoleonic, history, warfare stuff. Really cool. First book in a trilogy. I really liked it. Promise of Blood. What do you got, Crystal?
All right. Tickling my fancy this week and every week, really, since I discovered this band is Future Islands. I know I've mentioned them on the podcast before, but I've got some new news. First off, we do have their CD in the collection now. It's called Singles, so you can reserve that. But they just put out a remix of one of the songs on the album called Doves. And guess who did the remix? Vince Clark of Erasure. It's super cool. It's four on the floor, kinds of awesome. So we'll link to that in the show notes and check out Future Islands. All right, Bill, let's tickle in your fancy.
Tickling my fancy, I just discovered Kevin Pollak's chat show. I discovered his archives on YouTube. Kevin Pollak is a stand-up comic and actor. You might remember him from The Usual Suspects and A Few Good Men. Also, he was in Casino. I've watched three of the interviews, Dick Van Dyke, director John Landis, and Lost writer Damon Lindelof. And they're very funny, fast-paced, and informative. Also, they kind of have this, like, no time limit since they're filmed for the internet. And he goes on for, like, the John Landis almost lasted 3 hours. But it was never bored with it. It was just great. They talked about everything. And Dick Van Dyke, they're over 2 hours, and it's just great. They're sitting, there's a table, two chairs, very minimal. It's very cheaply done, but the substance is there. I've really enjoyed it, and it's great to listen to when I'm checking in bins. So, watch or listen to on YouTube Kevin Pollak's chat show. Amanda?
Well, I've been kind of waiting for this to finally hit Freegal. It's been out for a little bit, but Weird Al Yankovic has a new album out called Mandatory Fun, and it finally hit Freegal. If you have listened to any Top 40 radio in the last year, you will know half of these songs. He does his standard, polka mashup that is hilarious. My two favorite songs are Foil, which is a parody of Royals.
Yeah, that one is great.
It's hilarious.
The video is amazing. The video.
Yeah. I need to watch the video. I have not. I've heard good things. Microbes, enzymes, mold, and oxidation. I don't care. I've got a secret trick up my sleeve. I never bother with baggies, glass jars, Tupperware containers, plastic, cling wrap, really a no-brainer. I just like to keep all my flavors sealed and tight with aluminum foil. Foil. Never settle for less. That kind of wrap is just the best to keep your sandwich nice and fresh. And then he also has Word Crimes, which is a parody of Blurred Lines.
That should get best video of the year.
Yeah.
The Word Crimes one?
Yes.
It's just so intelligent. It's just things you want to say to people. I mean, it really is. So it is finally up on Freegal, Mandatory Fun. I will say that his originals they're pretty standard for him. I never really liked the originals as well as the parodies. But the parodies are absolutely worth it.
So in the corrections segment, I was actually going to call us out for not talking about World Out or Comic-Con, but you came through.
Yes.
So thank you. Appreciate that.
Keeping it real.
I was like, how are we not talking about those things? Like, this is the...
I was waiting for it to go to Freegal.
We're so nerdy that we're not talking about Weird Al. We're like, we're talking about Shakespeare.
We're so rebellious that we, skip a step and
Yeah, we jumped way over that.
Iconoclast.
Hey, it is a library podcast, right? So this is what I wanted to talk about. The new Dungeons & Dragons came out this summer, and I got to get this in before, all the buzz about it dies down. And when I talked about Shadowrun a few weeks ago, Greg, and I wish he was here so I could pick on him about this, he got this barb in, right, that you could play the video game instead of being creative. And with the Shadowrun video game, actually, they've made it so you actually can be very creative. You can create your own levels and for other adventures to play. That's one of the awesome things about video games now that, blows my old man mind is that, you play this game. You're not just, you don't just run through the game itself. The game is like a social network, and people in the social network build the game together, and you can make your own weapons and things like that, and that all is part of the game. Now, still, your creativity is still limited somewhat. But if you want to have total creativity, how you can do that is you can play a tabletop role-playing game. And this year is the 40th anniversary of Dungeons & Dragons, the first tabletop role-playing game. And in July, they did a total reboot of the game. Technically, this is the fifth edition of the game that's come out in 40 years. But they actually did away with the edition numbers. This is Dungeons & Dragons. So just anyone that doesn't know, like, what the heck I'm talking about, like, how this works is you create a character. You, like, write a character, like, as if you were writing a novel or writing a play. And then that character has certain, like, numerical attributes about them. And then one other person, like, creates a story for your character to go on or a group of people to go on together. And then they play and create, like, all the other characters and the adventures. Then you sit down together and you do the story together. And if you have to have a combat or anything, you roll dice to figure out like who wins the fight, things like that. And basically it's like total creativity and it's very immersive. And a lot of the articles that have come out recently with the 40th anniversary are about all these writers who like, I played Dungeons and Dragons. And I can remember you were talking about Denise Mina and Megan Abbott. They both have PhDs. And I said, man, these writers are really smart. And I usually don't bring this up because I play D&D and I don't want to say like I'm smart because I play D&D. But think about the people who are in D&D are usually people who are really smart. And, you know, they're not nerds because they play D&D. They're nerds because they're really smart. And that's also why they like D&D. I think it actually ties into Summer Challenge too, because in my experience with D&D is like a gateway to so much knowledge, because if you're the person that's making a character or writing an adventure for your friends to play, you start learning about castles. You start learning about dragons. You start learning about cannons and mythology. And you start learning about swords. And you start learning about all this. You need to learn all that the same way just like if you were a writer that was creating a world. And then, of course, that's sort of the brainiac stuff about it. There's also the role play aspect and the socialization that happens. Now that I'm an adult, and when I think about like tabletop role playing games now, I don't really think about it in terms of, boy, that's nerdy. I think about it in terms of like, why don't like more adults do this? Because if you're an adult and you wanted to do something that was fun and immersive and totally freeform and always engaging, why wouldn't you play a role-playing game with your friends? You know, it's like theater, but then there's also math. And then, of course, the way I described it was really...
Theater and math.
That's exciting. Why I
plus math. Five to lame.
Well, I guess when I say there's like theater and math, it was just a lead-in to say that there's this huge spectrum of what the games are like. So some games are just more like theater games, like improvisational game with no dice rolling or very minimal dice rolling. And then other games are all about the details and the math, and there's a chart and there's dice. And it's just like, if that's what you're into, that's what your friends are into, and you have that kind of personality, like you can just totally fall down that hole if that's what you're into, right? Or you can just be totally more freeform, and there's every kind of game for every kind of person. Of course, the game that set the blueprint was Dungeons & Dragons, and that's in a fantasy world, so there's elves and dragons and wizards and magic and things like that. But there's also every kind of game and every kind of setting. So every genre of book or movie that we've ever talked about, like noir or spy thrillers or bizarre mundane things, games about running a business, games about, you just name it, like being on a ship in the 17th century or being a pirate or whatever, you name it, there's a game that has been created that's set in that setting. I love them, and it's a lot of fun. And with the new edition of Dungeons & Dragons, I'm very pleased to see that the Player's Handbook, which is the first sort of like big book that you kind of need if you're really into it, it's not even been released yet, and it's still on the Amazon bestseller list. People are just buying it, pre-ordering it. It's already there. Of course, dude, if you just totally want to play, you don't want to buy hardcover books, you can just get the PDF of the rules of the game for free, and I'll link to those. And you can play with just that PDF. You don't have to go and buy the Player's Handbook if you just want to get started. Dungeons & Dragons 5th edition, it just made me super excited. And I blame Greg, too, because the thing that got me back into tabletop role-playing games, Greg had started the program, Create Your Own Superhero, at for the kids to do in the children's department. And then I was like, you know, you could turn that into a role-playing game. And then I got back into the role-playing game world trying to figure out, like, well, what game system would be best to make that work. So thank you, Greg.
Hey, Greg.
And then the media only fueled it because the new version of D&D came out and there were stories everywhere.
So I played it twice. Does that make me smart?
I played it twice.
Hey.
But see, this is why I did.
My husband is a huge D&D guy.
I found that talking D&D to other people was too much for me.
I don't like the math. Like I'm not a good dice roller. Like I suck at dice, so I was always getting like two. So every time I tried something, I would die. So you're the dumbest character ever.
I like to shoot my fire arrows. Oh wait, it went into my face instead of the monster's face.
I burned my eyebrows off. Darn it! But I did think of when I was reading Into Thin Air, I thought about a great bad guy for D&D. If Nick ever writes a new adventure, they have those falling Sereks that are like those huge blocks of ice. Oh, that's a great like villain. Like, you have this big ice monster. You call it the Great Falling Serek.
My favorite campaign was Planescape, where you went to different heavens and hells based on the alignment of the D&D characters.
Mm-hmm.
So there's like a lawful evil hell versus the chaotic evil hell and stuff. I thought that was kind of neat. I never actually played it because that involved talking.
You know, the artist who did the art for that setting, and what we're talking about is like sometimes people will write basically worlds for you to play inside of. And, you know, Planescape is one of those worlds that you could play in. And like, so it'll come with books with art and adventures and what all the monsters are and, you know, what the cities are, whatever. And Planescape was a really interesting one because it's, you know, traveling through different realms of reality. So here's some D&D lore that's kind of fun. The first D&D campaign where you could do that was called Spelljammer. And it was basically you were on, like, pirate ships in space, and each world was, like, a different dimension.
And literally, like, pirate ships, like, wooden ships.
Yes,
going
yes.
through space,
and,
yes.
And what was so great about that was...
Cool.
At the time that was written, the creative talent and the corporate management at TSR, who was the company that owned Dungeons & Dragons at the time, they didn't get along at all, and it was sort of, like, top-down. They're like, okay, we have to do a science fiction one. Right, so the creative talent at TSR who worked at Dungeons & Dragons, well, let's just, since they don't care and they won't let us do any playtesting to make a good game, let's just be as crazy as possible, right? Let's just whatever, right? Let's just as outlandish and bizarre as possible. And they created this study called Spelljammer that was like pirate ships in space, and of course it became beloved, like everyone loves it. And then also like the rules, the game mechanic for how you like travel between dimensions actually became what went into Planescape, which was actually more well-received. It was one of the last well-received products for that version of Dungeons & Dragons. So. Corrections from last week. Greg said Kyle McClanahan was in Hamlet, and it was not. It was Kyle MacLachlan. I would count that up to just mental flatulence, but Kyle MacLachlan is near and dear to my heart because he played Dale Cooper on Twin Peaks, and it was also Paul Muad'Dib in Dune. There was also a large segment cut out because I made a mistake, and I'm not going to say what it is. But the library has many, many things, and we try to emphasize that. So if the library didn't have something, we'd probably just cut that part out. And maybe if the library gets it later, we'll add it back in. But it ended up this really good conversation about Broadway musicals and comic books and mythology. And it was good. So maybe we'll use it later. And for more information, you can go to
www.library.nashville.org,
because we're an organization, and our theme music is by and he is not an organization.
Not the Dean or the Bursar. Dean Wormer. I'll get you, Delta House!
Seriously, well, we need content.
Laura McCall died.
Laura McCall died.
And Medicum
Golan Globus died. Who did?
The Golan of Golan Globus died.
Yes, of Canon Film.
Yeah.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah. Breaking Two, Electric Boogaloo.
Oh, man. Oh. Did you ever see Luke for Rig Nose Hercules?
I think I did. Oh, wow. Yeah.
Taking the bear and amazing. Throw it into space. I was one of the few movies I walked out of, and it turned into stars. And I thought, okay, I'm leaving.
Well, no, 7 or 8, that was amazing. But, like, yeah, I can see that. You know,
I don't take drugs, and I need to be drugs on this movie.
Too sober.